Everybody mind yourself, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and this is what one looks like. I want to thank Maureen for asking me to speak tonight. I think I spoke here maybe about 20 years ago or something, and I'm just delighted to be back. So, anyway, here's the thing. I'm an alcoholic because I love to drink. I mean, I love to drink, you know what I mean? Crash cars, love to drink. Lose job, love to drink. Lose all the relationships, love to drink. Broke, love to drink. You know? It didn't really matter what the consequence was. I just love to drink it. Whatever else you had, I love that too. Whatever it was. I can remember my first drink like it was yesterday, really. I was just, you know, like seventh grade or something like that. A couple of buddies and me, you know, we like stole a bunch of booze from our parents' bars and put them in little briefcases and took them to school to St. Paul's. Going to school with our little book bag of booze, you know. And we went down to the lake after, you know, school was over. And we had it stashed down at the lake in a place where it could get really nice and hot and terrible, you know. And we're sitting there, and it's about 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon by now, and we're just going to start drinking. Because now we're going to find out what this is all about. And, you know, they had a very normal reaction. They had a couple of drinks, and then they threw up. You know, because they got empty stomachs and everything else. I started drinking all their booze. I drank all my booze. I'm hugging the trees. I'm having the best time of my life. I mean, it was like heaven. Heaven. I never felt so good in my life. My reaction to alcohol was instantaneous. And from that point forward, I never met a drink I didn't like, and things just got... I held it together during high school. I really did. I looked good on the outside. My hobby was photography. I had a dark room in the basement with Developer and Fix and Rapid Fix. Rapid Fix was 100 proof vodka. So raking leaves was really a riot, I want to tell you. But I look good on the outside. Nobody could tell by looking at my outsides what was going on, you know, in the inside. I was a National Merit Scholar. I was president of my high school student association. I had offers from all kinds of colleges and universities all over the country. By the time I was 26 years old, I was homeless. I was penniless. I was sleeping under bushes in the city parks out in California. I had a bleeding ulcer, a bleeding colon, and transient neuropathy of the legs. And I didn't even think I had an alcohol or drug problem. I just thought I had a little cash flow problem. And if I could, you know, like get 20 bucks out of you, you know, everything would be all right. I was already into the one day at a time program, you know, which is what happens, you know what I mean? When you get really to the bottom, it's total one day at a time. I mean, you know, if it's Wednesday and you're deep in your alcoholism, are you worried about how you're going to get drunk on Saturday? No! You're worried about today! And that was me. I dropped out of college. I started hitchhiking around the country. I thought I was going to be the next Jack Kerouac and write all kinds of crazy things and, you know, be the great American writer. I was a complete disaster. So many bad things happened to me between the ages of 18 and 26. And I'm really not going to go into the whole long drunkologue because I don't think there's anybody here that needs any instruction in drinking. You know what I mean? So, all I can tell you is that I became so in love with alcohol that even when I was like flunking out of, I mean, I remember I got to the end of one term in college and I had aced my midterms and I just didn't show up for finals. 5 days. I just didn't show up. All I would have had to do is show up. Anything I would have done would have been enough to pass. And instead, I blew off the entire term. And I was sitting there on Friday afternoon when I was all over just thinking, what have I just done? you know, what have I just done? I've just destroyed. I mean, this costs money. And I thought, oh yeah, I can have a drink. Because that's the solution to every problem. You know, it's always the solution to every problem. Somebody lent me their car, I totaled it. Next morning I wake up, I'd forgotten I totaled it. Was reminded that I totaled it. What's the solution? A drink. Always. And that's why people can't talk to you about your alcoholism, because they're talking about it like it's a problem. You know, and for me, it's a solution. You know, so these lines are never going to meet. It was a very sad existence for me because I drank and used other things so much that I really couldn't hold jobs. I really couldn't support myself. I was always just, you know, mooching off people. And I'm just going to cut through all those years and just tell you that it is a terrible thing. I remember people trying to get me to see reason. And I got so mad that I hitchhiked from here to L.A. in January, which is one of the stupidest things you could ever do. I just about died, you know, about six different times on that trip, but that's how kind of defiant and crazy and just way out there that I was. I want to cut to the end of my drinking. I figured over those years, I hitchhiked or took buses or whatever for thousands and thousands of miles, and I would always gravitate up to the North Beach area of San Francisco, because that's where all the cool beat poets and writers and everybody used to hang out. And you know, I mean, the bars are legendary out there. Not that I could afford to drink in a bar. I didn't have the money to drink in a bar. But I could panhandle up enough money, because if you went to Safeway, you could buy a gallon of wine for $2.50. You know, and you could buy a pack of smokes for a buck. I mean, if that wouldn't get you to lunch, what would? You know. So, anyway, I was just so sick at the end. You know, I was throwing up blood. I had blood coming out the other end. I couldn't walk a lot of the time. I couldn't even hold the little busboy jobs that I would get from time to time. I was just sick. You know, I was just sick. 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 And I didn't understand anything, you know. I mean, I just really didn't. And then I heard through the grapevine that a friend of mine from high school had committed suicide, and I thought, that's the ticket. That is exactly the right thing to do. Because I couldn't see any other alternative. I couldn't see it. I didn't know anything about treatment. I didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know anything about anything. And so I decided that I was going to kill myself just the same way Ricky did. And I panhandled up enough money so I could get into a little flophouse room, $7 a night, and, you know, gave myself a little one-man going-away party, which is part of the reason I'm still here. And this is where God comes in. Because there I am, North Beach, San Francisco, getting ready to kill myself, and what happens? My brother's friend is on vacation and sees me walking down Columbus Avenue and sees the flop house I go into and calls my parents and says, "You've got to find him. This is the address of the place. He's going to die. He already looks like he's already dead." Now this, mind you, is 1981. That's how old I am. There are no cell phones. There's no, you know, none of that stuff. There's no way. There's no easy way to get a hold of people. I wake up the next morning hearing, you know, "You got a phone call." You don't get a phone call in a flop house. I mean, we're all broke. We don't even talk to each other. We're trying to find people to, you know, borrow $10 from. I wake up, I'm fully clothed, you know, bottles all over the place, and I just, you know, okay, go down the hall, go down three steps of stairs, three flights of stairs to the basement. There's a payphone hanging on the wall with a receiver hanging down. I pick up the phone. It is my father. He said, "Jeff, how you doing?" I said, "I can't talk to you," and I hung up. I mean, the last time I had talked to my father, I was in Chicago. I'm like, I'm freaking out. How does he find me in a flop house? I just went right across the street for the solution to Coit Liquors, where I could get a little half pint of port, go kitty corner the other way, sit in the middle of Washington Square Park, which is a one square block of green space in the middle of North Beach. And I just sat down in the grass at 8:30 in the morning and just started drinking. And you know, the Chinese people are over in the corner doing Tai Chi, you know, about 20 of them, and the other, you know, the little executive panic people are with their briefcases and they're all at work on Montgomery Street, you know, and everything else. And I'm just sitting there, 26-year-old punk kid, sitting there in the grass with a brown paper bag and a green bottle inside it, just drinking. And I'm like, how could this be? What's going to happen next? Are there going to be police? You know, am I going to be taken away? What's going on? I don't know. And I'm just looking down the neck of that bottle. And it was like my whole soul was being sucked down into that bottle. It felt like a black hole, a spiritual black hole. It was just being sucked right out of me. And I did something that I hadn't done since I was a little boy. I just started to cry like a fool in the middle of the grass in the park. I'm like, okay, now you're really pathetic. You're going to go back to that hotel room, that flophouse room, little 8x10 room, or like 6x8, and you're going to finish the job. But I knew I better call my parents first so that there wouldn't be like police or something like that, because, you know, it was just too weird. It was just too weird. There was a little kiosk over in the corner of the park, pay phones. I went over there and I called home. And somehow, I guess my parents had found somebody who knew something about intervention, so they were like really calm. Believe me when I tell you, we didn't have very many calm conversations in that era of my life. You know, when we did talk, it was like, you know, especially me and my father, it was like, it was not good. And I talked to my mom and put my dad on my, even my dad was calm. I'm talking to my dad, and he goes, "Jeff, how are you doing?" And I'm like, how am I doing, you know? And it's like, I all of a sudden, I didn't know what to say. I couldn't speak. You know, it's like, how am I doing? Well, let's see, I'm bleeding from both ends, and I can't walk, and I'm going to kill myself in about, 10 minutes? You know, I mean, I'm not saying this is what I'm thinking, right? You know? But at the same time, it's like the sun is shining, the birds are singing, there's like St. Peter and Paul Cathedral on the north end of the park there. It's like bathed in sunlight, even in North Beach and San Francisco. Sun never happens. And I don't know where it came from, but I said the single most intelligent thing I have ever said in my life. I don't know where the words came from. I said, "I think I need to go into a hospital." They've been waiting to hear that for years. Next thing I knew, there was a plane ticket. They talked to a doctor. The doctor said, "Let him keep drinking." All of a sudden, there was money. I could buy, you know, two double whiskeys at a time, you know, on the plane. It was fantastic. You could smoke on planes at that time, you know. I mean, it was amazing. And I got home, and they threw me in the back of the car the next morning and took me to the first detox bed that was available. Up at Hurley Hospital in Flint.
Yes.
Okay. And man, I was so sick. I could not even sign a decent signature to get into the admission. But they took me. And I was just sick. But the guy in the bed next to me was even sicker. He looked like he was 100 years old, this old alcoholic, and he was just all messed up. He couldn't even talk. I didn't want to talk. I had the bed by the window, and I just, like, moved away. And I think, but I don't know, but I think he died during the night. Because about 2 o'clock in the morning, about 75 people came into that room and started working on him like crazy. It was just like bedlam. I just like turned toward the window. You know, I just want to pretend I was asleep. You know what I mean? I was just like, you know, I don't know what's going on, but I don't want to, I don't know. And then they all got quiet and they wheeled him out. I don't know what happened. I woke up the next day and I was just sick. You know, I'm sitting there shaking and sweating and having a terrible time. I'm wearing those funky green detox pajamas that tie up in the back so your butt's hanging out, you know what I mean? Just sitting there on the side of the bed. And the head doctor comes in to talk to me, Dr. William Keating. I'll never forget him. Great, big, powerful black man. He looked like James Earl Jones in his prime, you know what I mean? Coming into the room, it's like God himself coming into the room. White coat, stethoscope, clipboard. I'm this punk kid sitting on the side of the bed, all sick. And he pulls and gets a chair and he cuts right up in my face like this, you know. And he says, boy! And I'm like, jeez! Boy, you got a disease. He said, you're not responsible for what you've done. And I'm like, great. He said, but you're responsible for what you do now. And I'm like, shit. He said, your disease is incurable. The most we're going to be able to do is put it in remission. We're going to give you a program to follow, 12 steps. You follow that program, the disease will stay in remission. You stop following that program, and the disease is going to kick you in the ass again. And he stood up, and he walked out. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I didn't know anything about AA, or 12 steps, or disease, or, you know. I just, you know. And yet, I remember what Dr. Keating said. Just like it was yesterday, it was a perfect little nugget of information that doctor gave me. You know, normally you go through detox and it's like 3 days, 5 days, something like that. They kept me in the hospital for 10 days before they would transfer me to residential. Just to give you an idea of how sick I was. And that was at the age of 26. I mean, it was a couple days later before I had, you know, for the first time in years, my first solid bowel movement. It was like a spiritual awakening. Thank you, Jesus. Healing is possible. A few days later, they let me go to my first AA meeting. You know, first of all, they gave me another pair of pajamas so I could one tie up in the back, one tie up in the front, you know. Little paper slippers so I could walk down the hall and smoke cigarettes with the big boys in the lounge. Yes, you could smoke in hospitals in those days. Yes, you could. Anyway, I went to my first AA meeting. What a trip that was. Then this guy came in from the outside. His name was Zeb. I'll never forget him. He was about 100 years old, probably about my age. He was this little wiry, white-haired guy with fiery blue eyes, and he was just fantastic. He said, like, my name's Zeb, I'm an alcoholic, I drank for 25 years, I've been sober for 25 years, there ain't nothing about this shit I don't know. I just liked him right from the start, you know what I mean? He was like, you know those old men bars that open at 7 a.m., you know, people be standing out there in the cold waiting for the door to open? That'd be the kind of Zeb, you know, bar, you know what I mean? He'd be out there with you, you know? 7:05, he's got his second Bloody Mary mustache going and the whole thing, you know? Anyway, Zeb, you know, we're all sitting around and, you know, these kind of chairs and some kind of makeshift circle. And Zeb apparently knew one of the other patients, this middle-aged guy who was sitting right next to me. And Zeb goes, Harry, what the hell are you doing here? And Harry, sitting right next to me, goes, well, I was sober for about 7 years. And I'm like, what? Yeah, I was sober for about 7 years, and then you know, I cut back on my meetings, and then I quit going to meetings, and then I had a drink, then I had a whole bunch of drinks, and pretty soon I was worse off than I ever was before. And I'm like, damn, the disease kicked him in the ass again, just like the doctor said. It was starting to sink in, you know. How many times have I heard Harry's story now, all these years later, you know? But it made a big impression on me, even at the time. So I did transfer down to a 28-day program. And I'm going through that, and, you know, I'm just kind of doing the deal, and breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I mean, the only thing I really remember about that was that people were nice. You know, they treated me like a human being, and not very many people treated me that way in that era of my life. You know, they were really nice. But it was getting down to the end of my treatment, and the problem was that when I was in college, I was a philosophy major, so now I was way too smart, and I didn't believe in anything. I didn't believe in, you know, I'd been like head of the altar boys at St. Paul's. Now, I'm like a card-carrying atheist, and I will argue it to the ground. You know what I mean? Jehovah's Witness show up at my door Saturday morning. I'm like, come on in, boys. I'm sitting there with a beer and a joint. Let's do this thing. I was obnoxious. So I'm not really getting it. You know what I mean? They're introducing me to the steps and everything else, but I can't really, you know, get... Okay, step one, obviously, the... Powerless over alcohol, life's become unmanageable. Well, yeah, a little, you know, I guess. Unless Lisa will take me back. So I'm walking around, you know, it's getting down to the end of my treatment. I'm walking around outside. It's about this time of year, you know. So, like, if you're not depressed, you will be. You know what I mean? Clouds are about 8 feet off the ground. It's 37 degrees and drizzling. You know what I mean? Walking around trying to figure out what I'm going to do after treatment. Well, I could go stay with Lisa in California. I could go, maybe Helen will take me back to New York, you know? Well, I know Ann won't take me back in Atlanta because last time we were together, she tried to kill herself. So that's not going to work out. And then it hit me. It hit me so hard, just like, boom, just like a voice inside my head, the voice of truth. I'm going to drink again, and I'm going to die. And I'm like, no. I've got, you know, I'll go, you know, I got options, you know, I'm going to drink again, and I'm going to die. And it became like an obsessive thought that just kept going and going and going. I'm going to drink again, I'm going to die. I'm going to drink again, I'm going to die. And I couldn't deny it. And I had been sober long enough now, you know, between the 10 days and then the residential and everything, that for once, I didn't want to die. Because you know how it is when you're out there drinking, you don't care. Death is like this oasis out on the horizon that if you make it there, you know what? It's going to be okay. Now, I'm like, no, I don't want to die, and I don't want to go back to living on the street. There is nothing worse than being dead broke, walking down the street. You're hungry. You're so hungry, and you're weak, and you've got no place to go and no way to buy food, and you've got to wait till the soup kitchen opens up. I'm telling you, it is a miserable existence. And I knew that's what I would go back to and then eventually die. So I'm like, no. I'm trying to figure out a solution. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. But all I could think about was, I'm going to drink again, I'm going to die. Go in, have dinner, you know, whatever the evening thing was, I'm going to drink again, I'm going to die, drink it. Of course, I'm not telling anybody anything, you know, because I can't get to a weed program yet. You know, and I finally get up to my room, and I mean, I'm up all night. I just can't even think about what to do, you know. I mean, I just, all I can think is, I'm going to drink again, I'm going to die, I'm going to drink again, I'm going to die. And I became so desperate to get some kind of a solution, you know, and I did not know what to do. And I'd be pacing back and forth in my room. There's like a big picture window there. And I'm looking at the picture window and it's dark outside. So all I can see is the reflection of me. And I'm like lost. You know, I am lost. And finally, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I finally did something that would have only happened in the depths of despair and desperation. And out of that came all of my recovery. And this is what I did. I got down on my knees in the middle of my room, and I put my hands together and I just said, God, help me. God, help me. And you know, when you get down into this position, all that three-quarters cocky BS is all gone. And I cried out to the God that I didn't think I believed in, with no hope. And all of a sudden, it was like I was in under a waterfall, but it was like a waterfall made of light. A waterfall made of light and love that was just washing over me. I was in the presence of God. I was in the presence of the God of our universe. It was the most powerful experience of my life, and I could feel every foul thing being washed out of me, and I realized I could stay sober now because it wasn't me anymore. There was a power greater than myself. It was like I was in a rapture. I don't know how long it went on. It seemed like a half hour. And I woke up and I knew I could stay sober. It was the most amazing experience of my life. And I realized in those moments that what we think of as, you know, reality and all this kind of stuff, we have no idea. The only real reality is love. And in that love, we live and move and have our being. We really do. We just don't know it. But, like any good alcoholic, I was ready to mess it up the very next day. Oh, yeah, totally, you know. Because, I mean, it was such a big experience, I couldn't wait to get back to that again, right? You know, I'm like, okay, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, group therapy, individual counseling, relaxation, I just can't wait to get back up to my room so I can get down on my knees and say, God help me. God help me. Nothing. I sat down on the edge of my bed, and I could almost feel, it was almost like a physical thing. It was like a buddy of mine going, come on, you know, just giving me a little shove. And I realized something. I realized that the experience that I'd had the night before was the most real thing that had ever happened to me in my life. And number two, it wasn't going to be repeated every night like some magical mystery tour for my entertainment. Okay? Now I was going to have to work these steps. But the funny thing is, they all made sense to me now. You know what I mean? They really made sense. I admitted I was powerless, that my life has become unmanageable. Powerless in the sense that I didn't even want to drink and I knew I would. Have you ever had that experience? I mean, I remember when I lost my job. I'm living with my girlfriend in Chicago, and, you know, and she's like, you know, if you drink, I'm going, I am leaving, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay. You know, it's Saturday morning, 9 o'clock, Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, I'm in the bar. I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't. I know this is going to destroy my life, but you know what? I'm an alcoholic. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. Now, if you really admit that, then you got to get to step two and come to believe that a power greater than yourself is going to restore you to sanity. Do you know how radical an idea that is? That is not the way we think. If I've got a problem, I got to fix it. Right? You know, I mean, that's the way we normally think. I got a problem. I got to figure it out. I got to fix it. I got to do this or that and that. AA says, nope. Not going to work. You little alcoholic. No, I got to come to believe that a power greater than myself is going to restore me to sanity. Maybe it's that vertical relationship with a power greater than myself. Maybe it's the horizontal relationship, you know, of God working through people. All these beautiful channels of God's love that I see sitting before me right now. Because that is the way God normally works. God normally works through people. Oh, sure, you've got, you know, sometimes you get the salt and Paul moments, or you get the white light experience or something like that, but you know what? That's not every day. So step two for me is like the linchpin of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how you really know if you're getting there. If you can come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. And if you want to see if you're there yet, just go right to step three. Because there's the test. Make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. Of course, it's we, but... And that's the trick, isn't it? And I didn't get the step at first. I didn't get it right. Because what I heard was that I had to turn my will and my life over to God. That's not what step three says. Step three says, make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood him. To make our lives and will congruent with what God would have me do. Because, let's face it, I'm a human being. I've got free will. I can't, like, pull out my will like a set of car keys and turn them over. I have free will. The most I can do is try to make my will congruent with God's will, in line with God's will. What would God have me do? It's actually not very hard to figure out. You know, a lot of times early on, I'm like, wow, what would God want me to do? Probably rule the world or something. You know, but this insane grandiosity, you know what I mean? I'm like sleeping in the park. I've got one eyeball in the dirt. You know, I'm like, no, I'm fine. You know, but I still think I'm going to rule the world. You know, and it doesn't get better in early sobriety. I'll rule it better now. What would God have me do? Not drink, okay? But aside from that, how about this? How about we keep it really simple? Because I have to. I really do. Because, you know, I'm crazy. Here's the first thing. Get out of bed. You might think that that's funny. It's not. Because when do you have the very worst thoughts of the day? You haven't even gotten out of bed yet. You haven't even opened your eyes yet. I'm already awfulizing. You know what I mean? The thinker is on. You know what I mean? The brain is like, I haven't even opened my eyes yet. All the problems of the world and even worse ones that I had. I mean, they're all like crowding in and saying, you know, there's no hope. So you know what? Get out of bed. Go to the bathroom. Brush your teeth. And then for me, I'm going to have my first cup of coffee with God. I'm going to sit there and read my 24 hours a day, my daily reflections, my, you know, I'm going to sit down and try to get my head back on track because it's already way gone. And then I'm going to go to work. Okay, so that takes another big piece of the day. I'm going to try to eat something besides Dairy Queen. You know, I mean, just try to get a little bit better on track. Not Dunkin' Donuts, but, you know. And then I'm going to have dinner, and I'm going to talk to people, and then I'm going to go to an AA meeting, and then I'm going to go out after the AA meeting, and then I'm going to be completely exhausted and go to bed. It's not that hard. I don't have to have a grander plan than that early on. Or, as I sit here before you with 41 years, I don't need a grander plan than that. Because God puts a lot before me every single day. God gives me lots to do. Okay, I'm very fortunate in my life that I get, you know, have the career that I have and the things that I do. I mean, I have a lot of opportunity to do a lot of things, and it's great. But it starts with getting out of bed, having my first cup of coffee with God, getting busy with whatever he puts in front of me, and getting to a meeting and doing the work. Okay. I can't tell you, the first year that I was sober, absolutely everything that I wanted to have happen. Thank you so much. Talk about instrument of God. Thank you, Jesus. Or my everything in my first year of recovery that I wanted to have happen went down the tubes. Everything went sideways. Everything went wrong. I wasn't able to get back to the girlfriend. I wasn't able to do this. I wasn't able to do this. Da, 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 da. Everything that I wanted, nothing worked out. Except I stayed sober. And I got to the end of that first year. And I realized my life was really good. You know, all in all, it was really pretty darn good. And I realized that all of my plans had to fail in order for God's plans to come forward. And that was a huge lesson for me. I still struggle with that, you know. But now I realize, you know, when things do fall apart, when things don't go the way, you know, that I want them, maybe that's just the way they're supposed to be. And that can be a real cliche, and it can even be a cop-out and stop you from doing things. But often there's a lot of wisdom in it. I remember being about 2 years sober, walking around on a beautiful fall day with my 2 years in sobriety girlfriend, and you know what I mean, just walking around and talking. And I was having a bad day, and I'm just complaining, and I'm carrying on, and going on and on and on and on. And she is very patient and listening to me as we go through the leaves and the sidewalk and blah, 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 blah. And after listening to me for an interminable period of time, she finally said, "But Jeff, you know, things are really all right now." And it was like, boom, they were. You know what I mean? I was employed, I was sober, I had a girlfriend, I had a car, I had, you know, I mean, actually everything was okay right now. It was fine. But where was I? Way in the future, way in the past. I was anywhere except where I was supposed to be, right here, right now. And that's still why I find it so important to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'll be sitting around a table and somebody say, "Well, you know, I just decided I had to take it one day at a time." And I'm like, "Oh my God, you're right." Seriously. You know? Oh, there's a newcomer at my Saturday morning meeting. Oh, he was, what was it he said? Oh, he, you know, I mean, he's been sober like 25 minutes or something. You know? And he's an older guy, and he's been very successful, and he's like trying to figure it all out and everything. Was, and you know, and somebody told me, you know, just, I forget what it was, but it was one of the, you know, one of our just garden variety, you know, maxims and whatever. And for him, it was just like the greatest thing in the world. And he was sharing it with all of us because we had never heard of that doctrine. You know? And we were all like, "Oh, yeah. You know, yeah. Oh, that's so fantastic." You know, and inside we're all going, "Oh, yeah. You know, he's getting it. He's almost a step two." And speaking of one, two, and three, you know, I mean, that's like the minimum to stay sober. It's like the three legs of a stool. It's not, step one isn't going to do it. You got to, step one leaves you high and dry. You know, step one will make you crazy. "Oh, great, I can't drink? Then I just have to stand here? Whoa!" You know, that's why step two is so great with the sanity piece, restored to sanity. Yeah, right. And then step three. Four and five made so much sense to me. Boy, I had to do three, fourth and fifth steps to get it all out right, you know, because even after two, there was still something I was holding back, you know. And it's so important that it all comes out. You know, whatever it takes, whoever you have to do your fifth step with, it doesn't matter. And the reason it's all got to come out is because you know what it is and God knows what it is. So who are you keeping this secret from anyway? The great thing about a good fifth step is the humility that it gives somebody like me. It took a long time for me to figure out that six and seven were just a one day at a time program too. I mean, because God will remove the defects of character, but there's a trick. You know, I mean, it's like a dirty little trick. It's only for today. They might just be back tomorrow if you don't keep working your program. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm sorry, but this is an audit. There's no graduation here, right? You know, I mean, you just got to keep doing the deal. And 8 and 9, making those amends, so important. Step 10. Continuing to, I mean, the most important thing is learning to say, I'm wrong. And it pays dividends like nobody's business. You know what I mean? If you will admit you're wrong on the job, the boss will promote you. It's really true because he knows everybody else is lying to him and trying to cover up. You know, if you go to the boss and say, you know what, I really screwed up. I was supposed to do this. I didn't do it. I did this instead. I made a real mess. He's going to be like, okay, you're a manager. Step 11 is like the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous in one sentence. Maybe one of the most beautiful sentences ever written. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Whoa! What I really love about, you know, the beginning of the step, the word improved. The step assumes that you need improvement. I know I do. You know. And it tells you how to do it. You know. It's prayer and meditation. Having that first cup of coffee in the morning with God. I also like to have my last thing with God. You know what I mean? You want to make your life miserable in recovery? Make your last half hour or hour of the day on Facebook or on the news or on blah, 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 or blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, turn it off, man. I've started doing that for years now. So I make sure that when I go to bed at night, what I've been putting in for the last half hour or more has been really positive and really thoughtful and everything else. And you know what? It helps. Instead of having 18 cups of coffee more and watching the news, you know, now I'm disappointed that the reason AA worked when other programs didn't is because of step 12. It's because of carrying the message. It's because of the service part of this program. Other programs had come up with, you know, faith solutions or this kind of solution or that kind of solution, blah, blah, blah. But nobody had come up with this idea that you're going to help somebody else. And, you know, Bill Wilson tried for about 6 months and nobody got sober. And it was his brilliant wife, you know, Lois, who said, yeah, but Bill, you're staying sober. And he's like, oh, okay. I mean, really, if it isn't for Ann and Lois, there's no Ann. You know, Dr. Bob's wife, I mean, she's like the spiritual giant, believe me. And Sister Ignatia, if you haven't read her biography, it's worth it. At the hospital there. She was hilarious. She like forced everybody to do like a fourth and fifth step before there was a fourth and fifth step. She just pulled them out of their little ward and put them on the balcony. I don't know if you know this, but the history is when they had that little ward in Akron, you know, it was like at the end of this hallway and at the very end of the hallway, there was a door. You open the door and it's the balcony of the little chapel in the hospital. Okay, and she took every one of those guys by the collar, like this, or by the ear, or whatever. She's like an old-fashioned nun, you know. And she'd like haul them down when they were getting ready to get up, and she'd haul them down, sit them down, and say, you've got to make peace with your maker right now before you leave here. Really more like a third step. Anyway, I digress. Service is essential, okay, because if I don't give it away, look, this thing's a gift. We're coming up on Christmas now. How does gift exchange work? You tell me. If a friend comes to you let's say, you know, a few days before Christmas and says, hey, Jeff, I got a present for you. I want to give it to you right now. And I don't have his present for him. I'm like, no, wait a minute. I got a present for you too. Listen, we'll get together tomorrow. We'll have lunch. I'll give you a present. You give me a present. Okay, because that's how gift exchange works. You know what I mean? If you give me a birthday present, then I got to give you a birthday present, right? So, what gift are we going to give God? We've been given the gift of our lives. I didn't deserve it. I know a lot of people who have died who were nowhere near as bad as I was. What can I give back to God? I have to give back to make it even. I can be that imperfect but present instrument of his love in the world. Just to be kind, just to be patient, just to welcome the newcomer, just to do my little bit, just to clean up the coffee, not just scrubbing out the pot, but you know what? All the sweet and low and the sugar that gets on the counter with the cream, you know, it's all such a mess. It's such a good job. If you're having a problem with pride, it's a really good job. We've been given a gift, and it's so important for us to give it back. And what's the biggest service thing that we need to be doing right now, if I may say so? We need to get our butts back into the treatment centers and start telling our stories. Okay? Because they've been in isolation and COVID. They're not getting the AA message, and we need to be carrying it in there. It's great to take it into the jail and the prisons and stuff like that, but we got to get back into where the sick alcoholics are and welcome them into our fellowship. We've been given a gift, and now it's our turn and our privilege to give it back. To ask, as we see the opportunity, if you're not too sure about the God thing yet, that's okay. What would kindness have me do? What would love have me do? What would patience have me do? Those are all placeholders for God. I need to be the one to take up that little bit and do it. Because like I say, it's a gift. It's been given to us for free. Take the gift. Give the gift. Take the gift. Give the gift. It's worked for me. I know it'll work for you. God bless you.